school too, which you're not. If Father was determined to make me either a prig or a mule, and I am not a prig, why, it stands to reason I must be a mule. And so I am, said Tom, desperately. It's a great pity, said Louisa, after another pause, and speaking thoughtfully out of her dark corner. It's a great pity, Tom. It's very unfortunate for both of us.
Oh, you, said Tom. You were a girl, Lou, and a girl comes out of it better than a boy does.
I don't miss anything in you. You were the only pleasure I have. You can brighten even this place, and you can always lead me as you like. You are a dear brother, Tom, and while you think I can do such things, I don't so much mind knowing better. Though I do know better, Tom, and I'm very sorry for it. She came and kissed him, and went back into her corner again.
I wish I could collect all the facts we hear so much about, said Tom, spitefully setting his teeth, and all the figures and all the people who found them out, and I wish I could put 1,000 barrels of gunpowder under them and blow them all up together.
However, when I go to live with old Bounderby, I'll have my revenge.
Your revenge, Tom?
I mean I'll enjoy myself a little, and go about and see something and hear something. I'll recompense myself for the way in which I've been brought up.
But don't disappoint yourself beforehand, Tom. Mr. Bounderby thinks as Father thinks, and is a great deal rougher and not half so kind.
Oh, said Tom, laughing, I don't mind that. I shall very well know how to manage and smooth old Bounderby.
Their shadows were defined upon the wall, but those of the high presses in the room were all blended together on the wall and on the ceiling, as if the brother and sister were overhung by a dark cavern, or a fanciful imagination, if such treason could have been there, might have made it out to be the shadow of their subject, and of its lowering association with their future.
What is your great mode of smoothing and managing, Tom? Is it a secret?
Oh, said Tom, if it is a secret, it's not far off. It's you. You are his little pet. You are his favourite. He'll do anything for you. When he says to me what I don't like, I shall say to him, my sister Lou will be hurt and disappointed, Mr. Bounderby. She always used to tell me she was sure you'd be easier with me than this. That'll bring him about or nothing will.
After waiting for some answering remark, and getting none, Tom wearily relapsed into the present time, and twined himself yawning round and about the rails of his chair, and rumpled his head more and more, until he suddenly looked up and asked, "Have you gone to sleep, Lou?"
"No, Tom. I'm looking at the fire."
"You seem to find more to look at in it than ever I could find," said Tom. "Another of the advantages, I suppose, of being a girl."
"Tom," inquired his sister slowly, and in a curious tone, as if she were reading what she asked in the fire, and it was not quite plainly written there.
"Do you look forward with any satisfaction to this change to Mr. Bounderby's?"
"Why, there's one thing to be said of it," returned Tom, pushing his chair from him and standing up. "It'll be getting away from home."
"There is one thing to be said of it,"
Louisa repeated in her former curious tone.
"It will be getting away from home. Yes.
Not but what I should be very unwilling both to leave you, Lou, and to leave you here. But I must go, you know, whether I like it or not, and I'd better go where I can take with me some advantage of your influence than where I should lose it altogether, don't you see?"
"Yes, Tom."
The answer was so long in coming, though there was no indecision in it, that Tom went and leaned on the back of her chair to contemplate the fire which so engrossed her from her point of view, and see what he could make of it.
"Except that it is a fire," said Tom, "it looks to me as stupid and blank as everything else looks. What do you see in it? Not a circus."
"I don't see anything in it, Tom, particularly. But since I've been looking at it, I have been wondering about you and me, grown up."
"Wondering again," said Tom.
"I have such unmanageable thoughts," returned his sister, "that they will wonder."
"Then I beg of you, Louisa," said Mrs. Gradgrind,
who had opened the door without being heard,
to do nothing of that description, for goodness sake, you inconsiderate girl, or I shall never hear the last of it from your father. And, Thomas, it is really shameful, with my poor head continually wearing me out, that a boy brought up as you have been, and whose education has cost what yours has, should be found encouraging his sister to wonder when he knows his father has expressly said that she is not to do it.
Louisa denied Tom's participation in the offence, but her mother stopped her with a conclusive answer.
Louisa, don't tell me in my state of health, for unless you had been encouraged, it is morally and physically impossible that you could have done it.
I was encouraged by nothing, mother, but by looking at the red sparks dropping out of the fire and whitening and dying. It made me think, after all, how short my life would be, and how little I could hope to do in it.
Nonsense, said Mrs. Gradgrind, rendered almost energetic. Nonsense! Don't stand there and tell me such stuff, Louisa, to my face, when you know very well that if it was ever to reach your father's ears, I should never hear the last of it. After all the trouble that has been taken with you, after the lectures you have attended and the experiments you have seen, after I have heard you myself, when the whole of my right side has been benumbed, going on with your master about combustion and calcination and calorification, and I may say every kind of ation that could drive a poor invalid distracted, to hear you talking in this absurd way about sparks and ashes. I wish, whimpered Mrs. Gradgrind, taking a chair and discharging her strongest point before succumbing under these mere shadows of facts. Yes, I really do wish that I had never had a family, and then you would have known what it was to do without me.
Chapter 9. Sissy's Progress. Sissy Jupe had not an easy time of it between Mr. Machocomchild and Mrs. Gradgrind, and was not without strong impulses in the first months of her probation to run away. It hailed facts all day long so very hard, and life in general was open to her as such a closely ruled ciphering book that assuredly she would have run away, but for only one restraint. It is lamentable to think of, but this restraint was the result of no arithmetical process, was self-imposed in defiance of all calculation, and went dead against any table of probabilities that any actuary would have drawn up from the premises. The girl believed that her father had not deserted her. She lived in the hope that he would come back, and in the faith that he would be made the happier by her remaining where she was. The wretched ignorance with which Jupe clung to this consolation, rejecting the superior comfort of knowing on a sound arithmetical basis that her father was an unnatural vagabond, filled Mr. Gradgrind with pity. Yet what was to be done? Machocomchild reported that she had a very dense head for figures, that once possessed with the general idea of the globe, she took the smallest conceivable interest in its exact measurements, that she was extremely slow in the acquisition of dates, unless some pitiful incident happened to be connected therewith, that she would burst into tears on being required, by the mental process, immediately to name the cost of 247 muslin caps at 14 pence halfpenny, that she was as low down in the school as low could be, that after 8 weeks of induction into the elements of political economy, she had only yesterday been set right by a prattler 3 feet high for returning to the question, what is the first principle of this science, the absurd answer, to do unto others as I would that they should do unto me. Mr. Gradgrind observed, shaking his head, that all this was very bad, that it showed the necessity of infinite grinding at the mill of knowledge, as per system, schedule, blue book, report, and tabular statements A to Z, and that Jupe must be kept to it. So Jupe was kept to it, and became low-spirited, but no wiser. "It would be a fine thing to be you, Miss Louisa," she said one night, when Louisa had endeavoured to make her perplexities for next day something clearer to her. "Do you think so? I should know so much, Miss Louisa. All that is difficult to me now would be so easy then." "You might not be the better for it, Sissy." Sissy submitted after a little hesitation. "I should not be the worse, Miss Louisa." To which Miss Louisa answered, "I don't know that." There had been so little communication between these two, both because life at Stone Lodge went monotonously round like a piece of machinery which discouraged human interference, and because of the prohibition relative to Sissy's past career, that they were still almost strangers. Sissy, with her dark eyes wonderingly directed to Louisa's face, was uncertain whether to say more or to remain silent.
"You are more useful to my mother and more pleasant with her than I can ever be," Louisa resumed. "You are pleasanter to yourself than I am to myself."
"But if you please, Miss Louisa," Sissy pleaded, "I am, oh, so stupid."
Louisa, with a brighter laugh than usual, told her she would be wiser by and by.
"You don't know," said Sissy, half crying, "what a stupid girl I am. All through school hours I make mistakes. Mr. and Mrs. Machocom Child call me up over and over again regularly to make mistakes. I can't help them. They seem to come natural to me."
"Mr. and Mrs. Machocom Child never make any mistakes themselves, I suppose, Sissy."
"Oh, no," she eagerly returned. "They know everything."
"Tell me some of your mistakes."
"I'm almost ashamed," said Sissy with reluctance. "But today, for instance, Mr. Machocom Child was explaining to us about natural prosperity."
"National, I think it must have been," observed Louisa.
"Yes, it was, but isn't it the same?"
she timidly asked.
"You had better say national, as he said so," returned Louisa with her dry reserve.
"National prosperity. And he said, now, this schoolroom is a nation, and in this nation there are 50 millions of money. Isn't this a prosperous nation? Girl number 20, isn't this a prosperous nation? And ain't you in a thriving state?"
"What did you say?" asked Louisa.
"Miss Louisa, I said I didn't know. I thought I couldn't know whether it was a prosperous nation or not, and whether I was in a thriving state or not, unless I knew who had got the money and whether any of it was mine. But that had nothing to do with it. It was not in the figures at all," said Sissy, wiping her eyes.
"That was a great mistake of yours," observed Louisa.
"Yes, Miss Louisa, I know it was now. Then Mr. Machocom Child said he would try me again, and he said, this schoolroom is an immense town, and in it there are 1 million of inhabitants, and only 25 are starved to death in the streets in the course of a year. What is your remark on that proportion?"
"And my remark was, for I couldn't think of a better one, that I thought it must be just as hard upon those who were starved, whether the others were 1 million or 1 million million. And that was wrong, too."
"Of course it was." "Then Mr. Machocom Child said he would try me once more, and he said, here are the stutterings."
"Statistics," said Louisa.
"Yes, Miss Louisa, they always remind me of stutterings, and that's another of my mistakes. Of accidents upon the sea. And I find," Mr. Machocom Child said, "that in a given time 100,000 persons went to sea on long voyages, and only 500 of them were drowned or burnt to death. What is the percentage?"
"And I said, miss,"
here Sissy fairly sobbed, as confessing with extreme contrition to her greatest error,
"I said, it was nothing."
"Nothing, Sissy?"
"Nothing, miss, to the relations and friends of the people who were killed. I shall never learn,"
said Sissy.
"And the worst of all is that although my poor father wished me so much to learn, and although I am so anxious to learn, because he wished me to, I'm afraid I don't like it."
Louisa stood looking at the pretty, modest head as it drooped abashed before her until it was raised again to glance at her face. Then she asked,
"Did your father know so much himself that he wished you to be well taught too, Sissy?"
Sissy hesitated before replying, and so plainly showed her sense that they were entering on forbidden ground that Louisa added,
"No one hears us, and if anyone did, I'm sure no harm could be found in such an innocent question."
"No, Miss Louisa," answered Sissy upon this encouragement, shaking her head. "Father knows very little indeed. It's as much as he can do to write, and it's more than people in general can do to read his writing, though it's plain to me."
"Your mother? Father says she was quite a scholar. She died when I was born."
"She was..."
Sissy made the terrible communication nervously.
she was a dancer. Did your father love her?
Louisa asked these questions with a strong, wild, wondering interest peculiar to her, an interest gone astray like a banished creature and hiding in solitary places.
Oh, yes, as dearly as he loves me. Father loved me first, for her sake. He carried me about with him when I was quite a baby. We've never been asunder from that time.
Yet he leaves you now, Sissy.
Only for my good. Nobody understands him as I do. Nobody knows him as I do. When he left me for my good, he never would have left me for his own. I know he was almost broken-hearted with the trial. He will not be happy for a single minute till he comes back.
Tell me more about him, said Louisa. I will never ask you again.
Where did you live?
We travelled about the country and had no fixed place to live in. Father's a...
Sissy whispered the awful word.
A clown.
To make the people laugh, said Louisa, with a nod of intelligence.
Yes.
But they wouldn't laugh sometimes, and then Father cried. Lately they very often wouldn't laugh, and used to come home despairing.
Father's not like most. Those who didn't know him as well as I do, and didn't love him as dearly as I do, might believe he was not quite right. Sometimes they played tricks upon him, but they never knew how he felt them, and shrunk up when he was alone with me. He was far, far timider than they thought.
And you were his comfort through everything.
She nodded, with the tears rolling down her face.
I hope so. And Father said I was. It was because he grew so scared and trembling, and because he felt himself to be a poor, weak, ignorant, helpless man. Those used to be his words, that he wanted me so much to know a great deal and be different from him.
I used to read to him to cheer his courage, and he was very fond of that. They were wrong books. I'm never to speak of them here. But we didn't know there was any harm in them.
And he liked them, said Louisa, with a searching gaze on Sissy all this time.
Oh, very much. They kept him many times from what did him real harm. And often of a night, he used to forget all his troubles in wondering whether the Sultan would let the lady go on with a story, or would have her head cut off before it was finished.
And your father was always kind, to the last, asked Louisa, contravening the great principle and wondering very much.
Always, always, returned Sissy, clasping her hands. Kinder and kinder than I can tell.
He was angry only one night, and that was not to me, but Merrylegs.
Merrylegs, she whispered the awful fact, is his performing dog.
Why was he angry with the dog? Louisa demanded.
Father, soon after they came home from performing, told Merrylegs to jump up on the backs of the two chairs and stand across them, which is one of his tricks. He looked at Father and didn't do it at once. Everything of Father's had gone wrong that night, and he hadn't pleased the public at all. He cried out that the very dog knew he was failing and had no compassion on him. Then he beat the dog, and I was frightened and said, Father, Father, pray don't hurt the creature who is so fond of you. Oh, heaven forgive you, Father, stop. And he stopped, and the dog was bloody, and Father lay down crying on the floor with the dog in his arms, and the dog licked his face.
Louisa saw that she was sobbing, and going to her, kissed her, took her hand, and sat down beside her.
Finish by telling me how your father left you, Sissy. Now that I have asked you so much, tell me the end. The blame, if there is any blame, is mine, not yours.
Dear Miss Louisa, said Sissy, covering her eyes and sobbing yet, I came home from the school that afternoon, and found poor father just come home, too, from the booth. And he sat rocking himself over the fire, as if he was in pain. And I said, Have you hurt yourself, father? As he did sometimes, like they all did. And he said, A little, my darling. And when I came to stoop down and look up at his face, I saw that he was crying. The more I spoke to him, the more he hid his face,
and at first he shook all over and said nothing but my darling and my love.
Here Tom came lounging in and stared at the two with a coolness not particularly savouring of interest in anything but himself, and not much of that at present.
"I'm asking Sissy a few questions, Tom," observed his sister. "You have no occasion to go away, but don't interrupt us for a moment, Tom, dear."
"Oh, very well," returned Tom. "Only Father has brought old Bounderby home, and I want you to come into the drawing-room, because if you come, there's a good chance of old Bounderby's asking me to dinner, and if you don't, there's none."
"I'll come directly."
"I'll wait for you," said Tom, "to make sure." Sissy resumed in a lower voice.
"At last, poor Father said that he had given no satisfaction again, and never did give any satisfaction now, and that he was a shame and disgrace, and I should have done better without him all along. I said all the affectionate things to him that came into my heart, and presently he was quiet, and I sat down by him, and told him all about the school and everything that had been said and done there. When I had no more left to tell, he put his arms around my neck and kissed me a great many times. Then he asked me to fetch some of the stuff he used for the little hurt he had had, and to get it at the best place, which was at the other end of town from there. And then, after kissing me again, he let me go. When I'd gone downstairs, I turned back that I might be a little bit more company to him yet, and looked in at the door and said, 'Father dear, shall I take Merrylegs?' Father shook his head and said, 'No, Sissy, no. Take nothing that's known to be mine, my darling.' And I left him sitting by the fire. Then the thought must have come upon him, poor, poor Father, of going away to try something for my sake. For when I came back, he was gone."
"I say, look sharp for old Bounderby, Lou," Tom remonstrated.
"There's no more to tell, Miss Louisa. I keep the 9 oils ready for him, and I know he will come back. Every letter that I see in Mr. Gradgrind's hand takes my breath away and blinds my eyes, for I think it comes from Father, or from Mr. Sleary about Father. Mr. Sleary promised to write as soon as ever Father should be heard of, and I trust him to keep his word."
"Do look sharp for old Bounderby, Lou," said Tom with an impatient whistle. "He'll be off if you don't look sharp."
After this, whenever Sissy dropped a curtsy to Mr. Gradgrind in the presence of his family, and said in a faltering way, "I beg your pardon, sir, for being troublesome, but have you had any letter yet about me?" Louisa would suspend the occupation of the moment, whatever it was, and look for the reply as earnestly as Sissy did. And when Mr. Gradgrind regularly answered, "No, Jupe, nothing of the sort," the trembling of Sissy's lip would be repeated in Louisa's face, and her eyes would follow Sissy with compassion to the door. Mr. Gradgrind usually improved these occasions by remarking when she was gone that if Jupe had been properly trained from an early age, she would have remonstrated to herself on sound principles the baselessness of these fantastic hopes. Yet it did seem, though not to him, for he saw nothing of it, as if fantastic hope could take as strong a hold as fact. This observation must be limited exclusively to his daughter. As to Tom, he was becoming that not unprecedented triumph of calculation which is usually at work on number one. As to Mrs. Gradgrind, if she said anything on the subject, she would come a little way out of her wrappers like a feminine dormouse and say, "Good gracious, bless me, how my poor head is vexed and worried by that girl Jupe so perseveringly asking over and over again about her tiresome letters. Upon my word and honour, I seem to be fated and destined and ordained to live in the midst of things that I am never to hear the last of. It really is a most extraordinary circumstance that it appears as if I was never to hear the last of anything." At about this point, Mr. Gradgrind's eye would fall upon her, and under the influence of that wintry piece of fact, she would become torpid again.
Chapter 10. Stephen Blackpool. I entertain a weak idea that the English people are as hard-worked as any people upon whom the sun shines. I acknowledged to this ridiculous idiosyncrasy as a reason why I would give them a little more play. In the hardest working part of Coketown, in the innermost fortifications of that ugly citadel, where nature was as strongly bricked out as killing airs and gases were bricked in, at the heart of the labyrinth of narrow courts upon courts and close streets upon streets, which had come into existence piecemeal, every piece in a violent hurry for some one man's purpose, and the whole an unnatural family, shouldering and trampling and pressing one another to death. In the last close nook of this great exhausted receiver, where the chimneys, for want of air to make a draught, were built in an immense variety of stunted and crooked shapes, as though every house put out a sign of the kind of people who might be expected to be born in it, among the multitude of Coketown generically called the Hands, a race who would have found more favour with some people if Providence had seen fit to make them only hands, or, like the lower creatures of the seashore, only hands and stomachs, lived a certain Stephen Blackpool, 40 years of age. Stephen looked older, but he had had a hard life. It is said that every life has its roses and thorns. There seemed, however, to have been a misadventure or mistake in Stephen's case, whereby somebody else had become possessed of his roses, and he had become possessed of the same somebody else's thorns, in addition to his own. He had known, to use his words, a peck of trouble. He was usually called Old Stephen, in a kind of rough homage to the fact. A rather stooping man, with a knitted brow, a pondering expression of face, and a hard-looking head sufficiently capacious, on which his iron-grey hair lay long and thin, Old Stephen might have passed for a particularly intelligent man in his condition. Yet he was not. He took no place among those remarkable hands who, piecing together their broken intervals of leisure through many years, had mastered difficult sciences and acquired a knowledge of most unlikely things. He held no station among the hands who could make speeches and carry on debates. Thousands of his compeers could talk much better than he at any time. He was a good power loom weaver and a man of perfect integrity. What more he was, or what else he had in him, if anything, let him show for himself. The lights in the great factories, which looked, when they were illuminated, like fairy palaces, or the travellers by express train said so, were all extinguished, and the bells had rung for knocking off for the night, and had ceased again, and the hands, men and women, boy and girl, were clattering home. Old Stephen was standing in the street, with the old sensation upon him which the stoppage of the machinery always produced, the sensation of its having worked and stopped in his own head. "Yet I don't see Rachel still," said he. It was a wet night, and many groups of young women passed him, with their shawls drawn over their bare heads and held close under their chins to keep the rain out. He knew Rachel well, for a glance at any one of these groups was sufficient to show him that she was not there. At last there were no more to come, and then he turned away, saying in a tone of disappointment, "Why, they're not, mister." But he had not gone the length of three streets when he saw another of the shawled figures in advance of him, at which he looked so keenly that perhaps its mere shadow indistinctly reflected on the wet pavement, if he could have seen it without the figure itself, moving along from lamp to lamp, brightening and fading as it went, would have been enough to tell him who was there. Making his pace at once much quicker and much softer, he darted on until he was very near this figure, then fell into his former walk, and called, "Rachel!" She turned, being then in the brightness of a lamp, and raising her hood a little, showed a quiet, oval face, dark and rather delicate, irradiated by a pair of very gentle eyes, and further set off by the perfect order of her shining black hair. It was not a face in its first bloom. She was a woman 35 years of age. "Ah, lad, 'tis thou." When she had said this, with a smile which would have been quite expressed, though nothing of her had been seen but her pleasant eyes, She replaced her hood again, and they went on together.
I thought there was behind me, Rachel.
No. Early tonight, lass. Times I'm a little early, Stephen. Times a little late. I'm never to be counted on going home. Nor going t'other way neither, seems to me, Rachel.
No, Stephen.
He looked at her with some disappointment in his face, but with a respectful and patient conviction that she must be right in whatever she did. The expression was not lost upon her. She laid her hand lightly on his arm a moment, as if to thank him for it.
We are such true friends, lad, and such old friends, and getting to be such old folk now.
No, Rachel, thou art as young as ever thou wast.
One of us would be puzzled how to get old, Stephen, without t'other getting so too, both being alive,
she answered, laughing.
But anyways, we're such old friends, and to hide a word of honest truth from one another would be a sin and a pity. 'Tis better not to walk too much together.
Times, yes. 'Twould be hard indeed if 'twas not to be at all, she said, with a cheerfulness she sought to communicate to him.
'Tis hard anyways, Rachel. Try to think not, and 'twill seem better. I've tried a long time, and it ain't got better.
But thou art right. It might make folk talk, even of thee.
Thou hast been that to me, Rachel, through so many year. Thou hast done me so much good and heartened of me in that cheering way that thy word is a law to me.
Ah, lass, and a bright good law. Better than some real ones.
Never fret about them, Stephen,
she answered quickly, and not without an anxious glance at his face. Let the laws be.
Yes, he said, with a slow nod or two. Let them be. Let everything be. Let all sorts alone. 'Tis a muddle, and that's all.
Always a muddle, said Rachel, with another gentle touch upon his arm, as if to recall him out of the thoughtfulness in which he was biting the long ends of his loose neckerchief as he walked along.
The touch had its instantaneous effect. He let them fall, turned a smiling face upon her, and said as he broke into a good-humoured laugh,
"Hi, Rachel, lass, always a muddle. That's where I stick. I come to the muddle many times and again, and I never get beyond it."
They had walked some distance and were near their own homes. The woman's was the first reached. It was in one of the many small streets for which the favourite undertaker, who turned a handsome sum out of the one poor ghastly pomp of the neighbourhood, kept a black ladder, in order that those who had done their daily groping up and down the narrow stairs might slide out of this working world by the windows. She stopped at the corner, and putting her hand in his, wished him good night.
Good night, dear lass.
Good night.
She went with her neat figure and her sober womanly step down the dark street, and he stood looking after her until she turned into one of the small houses. There was not a flutter of her coarse shawl, perhaps, but had its interest in this man's eyes. Not a tone of her voice, but had its echo in his innermost heart. When she was lost to his view, he pursued his homeward way, glancing up sometimes at the sky where the clouds were sailing fast and wildly. But they were broken now, and the rain had ceased, and the moon shone, looking down the high chimneys of Coketown on the deep furnaces below, and casting titanic shadows of the steam engines at rest upon the walls where they were lodged. The man seemed to have brightened with the night as he went on. His home, in such another street as the first, saving that it was narrower, was over a little shop. How it came to pass that any people found it worth their while to sell or buy the wretched little toys mixed up in its window with cheap newspapers and pork, there was a leg to be raffled for tomorrow night, matters not here. He took his end of candle from a shelf, lighted it at another end of candle on the counter, without disturbing the mistress of the shop who was asleep in her little room, and went upstairs into his lodging. It was a room not unacquainted with the black ladder under various tenants, but as neat at present as such a room could be. A few books and writings were on an old bureau in a corner. The furniture was decent and sufficient, and, though the atmosphere was tainted, the room was clean. Going to the hearth to set the candle down upon a round, three-legged table standing there, he stumbled against something. As he recoiled, looking down at it, it raised itself up into the form of a woman in a sitting attitude.
"Heaven's mercy, woman," he cried, falling farther off from the figure. "Hast thou come back again?"
Such a woman. A disabled, drunken creature, barely able to preserve her sitting posture by steadying herself with one begrimed hand on the floor, while the other was so purposeless in trying to push away her tangled hair from her face that it only blinded her the more with the dirt upon it. A creature so foul to look at in her tatters, stains, and splashes, but so much fouler than that in her moral infamy, that it was a shameful thing even to see her. After an impatient oath or two, and some stupid clawing of herself with the hand not necessary to her support, she got her hair away from her eyes sufficiently to obtain a sight of him. Then she sat swaying her body to and fro, and making gestures with her unnerved arm, which seemed intended as the accompaniment to a fit of laughter, though her face was stolid and drowsy.
"Eh, lad, what you say?"
Some hoarse sounds meant for this came mockingly out of her at last, and her head dropped forward on her breast.
"Back again?"
she screeched after some minutes, as if he had that moment said it.
"Yes, and back again. Back again ever and ever so often. Back, yes, back, why not?"
Roused by the unmeaning violence with which she cried it out, she scrambled up and stood supporting herself with her shoulders against the wall, dangling in one hand by the string a dunghill fragment of a bonnet, and trying to look scornfully at him.
"I'll sell thee off again, and I'll sell thee off again, and I'll sell thee off a score of times," she cried,
with something between a furious menace and an effort at a defiant dance.
"Come away from the bed."
He was sitting on the side of it, with his face hidden in his hands.
"Come away from it. 'Tis mine, and I've a right to it."
As she staggered to it, he avoided her with a shudder and passed, his face still hidden, to the opposite end of the room. She threw herself upon the bed heavily, and soon was snoring hard. He sunk into a chair and moved but once all that night. It was to throw a covering over her, as if his hands were not enough to hide her, even in the darkness. Chapter 11. No Way Out. The fairy palaces burst into illumination before pale morning showed the monstrous serpents of smoke trailing themselves over Coketown. A clattering of clogs upon the pavement, a rapid ringing of bells, and all the melancholy mad elephants, polished and oiled up for the day's monotony, were at their heavy exercise again. Stephen bent over his loom, quiet, watchful, and steady. A special contrast, as every man was in the forest of looms where Stephen worked, to the crashing, smashing, tearing piece of mechanism at which he labored. Never fear, good people of an anxious turn of mind, that art will consign nature to oblivion. Set anywhere, side by side, the work of God and the work of man, and the former, even though it be a troop of hands of very small account, will gain in dignity from the comparison. So many hundred hands in this mill, so many hundred horse steam power. It is known to the force of a single pound weight what the engine will do. But not all the calculators of the national debt can tell me the capacity for good or evil, for love or hatred, for patriotism or discontent, for the decomposition of virtue into vice or the reverse, at any single moment, in the soul of one of these its quiet servants, with the composed faces and the regulated actions. There is no mystery in it. There is an unfathomable mystery in the meanest of them, forever. Supposing we were to reverse our arithmetic for material objects, and to govern these awful unknown quantities by other means. The day grew strong, and showed itself outside, even against the flaming lights within. The lights were turned out, and the work went on. The rain fell, and the smoke serpents, submissive to the curse of all that tribe, trailed themselves upon the earth, In the waste yard outside, the steam from the escape pipe, the litter of barrels and old iron, the shining heaps of coals, the ashes everywhere, were shrouded in a veil of mist and rain. The work went on until the noon bell rang. More clattering upon the pavements. The looms and wheels and hands, all out of gear for an hour. Stephen came out of the hot mill into the damp wind and cold wet streets, haggard and worn. He turned from his own class and his own quarter, taking nothing but a little bread as he walked along, towards the hill on which his principal employer lived, in a red house with black outside shutters, green inside blinds, a black street door, up two white steps, Bounderby, in letters very like himself, upon a brazen plate, and a round brazen door handle underneath it, like a brazen full stop. Mr. Bounderby was at his lunch, so Stephen had expected. Would his servant say that one of the hands begged leave to speak to him? Message in return, requiring name of such hand. Stephen Blackpool. There was nothing troublesome against Stephen Blackpool. Yes, he might come in. Stephen Blackpool in the parlour. Mr. Bounderby, whom he just knew by sight, at lunch on chop and sherry. Mrs. Sparsit, netting at the fireside, in a side-saddle attitude, with one foot in a cotton stirrup. It was a part at once of Mrs. Sparsit's dignity and service not to lunch. She supervised the meal, officially, but implied that in her own stately person she considered lunch a weakness.
"Now, Stephen," said Mr. Bounderby, "what's the matter with you?"
Stephen made a bow. "Not a servile one. These hands will never do that. Lord bless you, sir, you'll never catch them at that, if they've been with you 20 years. And as a complimentary toilet for Mrs. Sparsit, tucked his neckerchief ends into his waistcoat.
"Now, you know," said Mr. Bounderby, taking some sherry, "we have never had any difficulty with you, and you've never been one of the unreasonable ones. You don't expect to be set up in a coach and six and to be fed on turtle soup and venison with a gold spoon, as a good many of 'em do."
Mr. Bounderby always represented this to be the sole immediate and direct object of any hand who was not entirely satisfied.
"And therefore I know already that you have not come here to make a complaint. Now, you know, I am certain of that beforehand."
"No, sir, sure I've not come for nought of the kind."
Mr. Bounderby seemed agreeably surprised, notwithstanding his previous strong conviction.
"Very well," he returned. "You're a steady hand, and I was not mistaken. Now, let me hear what it's all about. As it's not that, let me hear what it is. What have you got to say? Out with it, lad."
Stephen happened to glance towards Mrs. Sparsit.
"I can go, Mr. Bounderby, if you wish it,"
said that self-sacrificing lady, making a feint of taking her foot out of the stirrup. Mr. Bounderby stayed her by holding a mouthful of chop in suspension before swallowing it and putting out his left hand. Then, withdrawing his hand and swallowing his mouthful of chop, he said to Stephen,
"Now, you know, this good lady is a born lady, a high lady. You are not to suppose, because she keeps my house for me, that she hasn't been very high up the tree, up at the top of the tree. Now, if you've got anything to say that can't be said before a born lady, this lady will leave the room. If what you have got to say can be said before a born lady, this lady will stay where she is."
"Sir, I hope I never had no to say not fitting for a born lady to hear sin I were born, missen,"
was the reply, accompanied with a slight flush.
"Very well," said Mr. Bounderby, pushing away his plate and leaning back. "Fire away."
"I've come," Stephen began, raising his eyes from the floor after a moment's consideration, "to ask you your advice. I need it overmuch. I were married on Easter Monday 19 years sin', long and dry. She were a young lass, pretty enough, with good accounts of hersen. Well, she went bad soon. Not along of me. God knows I were not an unkind husband to her."
"I've heard all this before," said Mr. Bounderby. "She took to drinking, left off working, sold the furniture, pawned the clothes, and played old gooseberry."
I were patient with her."
"The more fool you, I think," said Mr. Bounderby, in confidence to his wine glass.
I were very patient with her. I tried to wean her from it over and over again. I tried this, I tried that, I tried t'other. I've gone home many's the time and found all vanished as I had in the world, and her without a sense left to bless herself, lying on the bare ground. I've done it not once, not twice, 20 times.
Every line in his face deepened as he said it, and put in its affecting evidence of the suffering he had undergone.
From bad to worse, from worse to worsen. She left me. She disgraced herself every ways bitter and bad. She come back, she come back, she come back. What could I do to hinder her? I've walked the streets nights long ere ever I'd go home. I've gone to the brig, minded to fling myself o'er and ha' no more on it. I bore that much that I were old when I were young.
Mrs. Sparsit, easily ambling along with her netting needles, raised the Coriolanian eyebrows and shook her head, as much as to say,
"The great no trouble as well as the small. Please to turn your humble eye in my direction."
"I have paid her to keep away from me. These 5 years I've paid her. I've gotten decent futurals about me again. I've lived hard and sad, but not ashamed and fearful of the minutes of my life. Last night I went home. There she lay upon my hearthstone. There she is."
In the strength of his misfortune and the energy of his distress, he fired for the moment like a proud man. In another moment, he stood as he had stood all the time, his usual stoop upon him, his pondering face addressed to Mr. Bounderby with a curious expression on it, half shrewd, half perplexed, as if his mind was set upon unravelling something very difficult, his hat held tight in his left hand, which rested on his hip, his right arm, with a rugged propriety and force of action, very earnestly emphasizing what he said, not least so when it always paused a little bent, but not withdrawn, as he paused.
"I was well acquainted with all this, you know," said Mr. Bounderby, "except the last clause, long ago. It's a bad job, that's what it is. You'd better have been satisfied as you were, and not have got married. However, it's too late to say that."
"Was it an unequal marriage, sir, in point of years?"
asked Mrs. Sparsit.
"You hear what this lady asks. Was it an unequal marriage in point of years, this unlucky job of yours?" said Mr. Bounderby.
"Not e'en so. I were 21 myself, she were 20 nigh but."
"Indeed, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit to her chief with great placidity, "I inferred from its being so miserable a marriage that it was probably an unequal one in point of years."
Mr. Bounderby looked very hard at the good lady in a sidelong way that had an odd sheepishness about it. He fortified himself with a little more sherry.
"Well, why don't you go on?"
he then asked, turning rather irritably on Stephen Blackpool.
"I've come to ask you, sir, how I am to be rid of this woman."
Stephen infused a yet deeper gravity into the mixed expression of his attentive face. Mrs. Sparsit uttered a gentle ejaculation, as having received a moral shock.
"What do you mean?" said Bounderby, getting up to lean his back against the chimney-piece. "What you talking about? You took her for better for worse."
"I mun be ridden of her. I cannot bear it no more. I've lived under it so long, for that I had the pity and comforting words of the best lass living or dead. Haply but for her I should have gone battering mad."
"He wishes to be free to marry the female of whom he speaks, I fear, sir,"
observed Mrs. Sparsit in an undertone, and much dejected by the immorality of the people.
"I do. The lady says what's right, I do. I were a-coming to it. I've read in the papers that great folk, fair for them all, I wish them no hurt, are not bonded together for better for worse so fast, but that they can be set free from their misfortunate marriages and marry over again. When they do not agree for that the tempers is ill-sorted, they has rooms of one kind or another in the houses above a bit, and they can live asunders. We folk have only one room, and we can't. When that won't do, they have gold and other cash, and they can say, 'This for you and that for me,' and they can go their separate ways. We can't. In spite of all that, they can be set free for smaller wrongs than mine. So I must be ridden of this woman, and I want to know how."
"Know how," returned Mr. Bounderby.
"If I do her any hurt, sir, there's a law to punish me?"
"Of course there is."
"If I flee from her, there's a law to punish me?"
"Of course there is."
If I marry t'other dear lass, there's a law to punish me?
Of course there is.
If I was to live with her and not marry her, saying such a thing could be, which it never could or would, and her so good, there's a law to punish me and every innocent child belonging to me.
Of course there is.
Now, in God's name, said Stephen Blackpool, show me the law to help me.
There's a sanctity in this relation of life, said Mr. Bounderby, and it must be kept up.
No, no, do not say that, sir. 'Tain't kept up that way, not that way, 'tis kept down that way. I'm a weaver. I were in a factory when I were a child, but I've got eyes to see with and ears to hear with. I read in the papers every sizes, every sessions, and you read too, I know it, with dismay, how the supposed impossibility of ever getting unchained from one another at any price, on any terms, brings blood upon this land, and brings many common married folk to battle, murder, and sudden death. Let us have this right understood. Mine's a grievous case, and I want, if you will be so good, to know the law that helps me.
Now, I tell you what, said Mr. Bounderby, putting his hands in his pockets, there is such a law.
Stephen, subsiding into his quiet manner and never wandering in his attention, gave a nod.
But it's not for you at all. It costs money. It costs a mint of money.
How much might that be?
Stephen calmly asked.
Why, you'd have to go to Doctors' Commons with a suit, you'd have to go to a Court of Common Law with a suit, and you'd have to go to the House of Lords with a suit, and you'd have to get an Act of Parliament to enable you to marry again. It would cost you, if it was a case of very plain sailing, I suppose from 1,000 to 1,500 pound, said Mr. Bounderby. Perhaps twice the money.
There's no other law.
Certainly not.
Why then, sir, said Stephen, turning white and motioning with that right hand of his, as if he gave everything to the four winds. 'Tis a muddle. 'Tis just a muddle altogether. And the sooner I am dead, the better.
Mrs. Sparsit, again dejected by the impiety of the people.
Pooh, pooh! Don't you talk nonsense, my good fellow, said Mr. Bounderby, about things you don't understand. And don't you call the institutions of your country a muddle, or you'll get yourself into a real muddle one of these fine mornings. The institutions of your country are not your piecework, and the only thing you have got to do is to mind your piecework. You didn't take your wife for fast and for loose, but for better for worse. If she has turned out worse, why, all we have got to say is she might have turned out better.
'Tis a muddle, said Stephen, shaking his head as he moved to the door. 'Tis all a muddle.
Now I'll tell you what, Mr. Bounderby resumed as a valedictory address. With what I shall call your unhallowed opinions, you have been quite shocking this lady, who, as I have already told you, is a born lady, and who, as I have not already told you, has had her own marriage misfortunes to the tune of tens of thousands of pounds. Tens of thousands of pounds!
He repeated it with great relish.
Now, you have always been a steady hand hitherto, but my opinion is, and so I tell you plainly, that you are turning into the wrong road. You have been listening to some mischievous stranger or other. They're always about, and the best thing you can do is to come out of that. Now, you know, here his countenance expressed marvellous acuteness, I can see as far into a grindstone as another man, farther than a good many, perhaps, because I had my nose well kept to it when I was young. I see traces of the turtle soup and venison and gold spoon in this. Yes, I do, cried Mr. Bounderby, shaking his head with obstinate cunning. By the Lord Harry, I do.
With a very different shake of the head and deep sigh, Stephen said, Thank you, sir. I wish you good, dear. So he left Mr. Bounderby, swelling at his own portrait on the wall, as if he were going to explode himself into it. And Mrs. Sparsit, still ambling on with her foot in her stirrup, looking quite cast down by the popular vices. Chapter 12. The Old Woman. Old Stephen descended the two white steps, shutting the black door with the brazen doorplate, by the aid of the brazen full stop to which he gave a parting polish with the sleeve of his coat, observing that his hot hand clouded it. He crossed the street with his eyes bent upon the ground, and thus was walking sorrowfully away, when he felt a touch upon his arm.
It was not the touch he needed most at such a moment, the touch that could calm the wild waters of his soul, as the uplifted hand of the sublimest love and patience could abate the raging of the sea. Yet it was a woman's hand, too. It was an old woman, tall and shapely still, though withered by time, on whom his eyes fell when he stopped and turned. She was very cleanly and plainly dressed, had country mud upon her shoes, and was newly come from a journey. The flutter of her manner in the unwonted noise of the streets, the spare shawl carried unfolded on her arm, the heavy umbrella and little basket, the loose, long-fingered gloves to which her hands were unused, all bespoke an old woman from the country in her plain holiday clothes, come into Coketown on an expedition of rare occurrence. Remarking this at a glance with the quick observation of his class, Stephen Blackpool bent his attentive face, his face which, like the faces of many of his order, by dint of long working with eyes and hands in the midst of a prodigious noise, had acquired the concentrated look with which we are familiar in the countenances of the deaf, the better to hear what she asked him.
"Pray, sir," said the old woman, "didn't I see you come out of that gentleman's house?"
pointing back to Mr. Bounderby's.
"I believe it was you, unless I have had the bad luck to mistake the person in following."
"Yes, missus," returned Stephen, "it were me."
"Have you, you'll excuse an old woman's curiosity, have you seen the gentleman?"
"Yes, missus."
"And how did he look, sir? Was he portly, bold, outspoken and hearty?"
As she straightened her own figure and held up her head in adapting her action to her words, the idea crossed Stephen that he had seen this old woman before and had not quite liked her.
"Oh, yes," he returned, observing her more attentively. "He were all that."
"And healthy," said the old woman, "as the fresh wind."
"Yes," returned Stephen. "He were eating and drinking as large and as loud as a hummer bee."
"Thank you,"
said the old woman with infinite content.
"Thank you."
He certainly never had seen this old woman before, yet there was a vague remembrance in his mind, as if he had more than once dreamed of some old woman like her. She walked along at his side, and gently accommodating himself to her humour, he said Coketown was a busy place, was it not? To which she answered,
"Eh, sure, dreadful busy."
Then he said she came from the country, he saw, to which she answered in the affirmative.
"By parliamentary this morning. I came 40 mile by parliamentary this morning, and I'm going back the same 40 mile this afternoon. I walked 9 mile to the station this morning, and if I find nobody on the road to give me a lift, I shall walk the 9 mile back tonight. That's pretty well, sir, at my age," said the chatty old woman, her eye brightening with exultation.
"'Deed tis. Don't do it too often, missus."
"No, no. Once a year," she answered, shaking her head. "I spend my savings so, once every year. I come regular to tramp about the streets and see the gentlemen."
"Only to see them," returned Stephen.
"That's enough for me," she replied, with great earnestness and interest of manner. "I ask no more. I've been standing about on this side of the way to see that gentleman," turning her head back towards Mr. Bounderby's again, "come out. But he's late this year, and I've not seen him. You came out instead. Now, if I'm obliged to go back without a glimpse of him, I only want a glimpse. Well, I've seen you, and you have seen him, and I must make that do."
Saying this, she looked at Stephen, as if to fix his features in her mind, and her eye was not so bright as it had been. With a large allowance for difference of tastes, and with all submission to the patricians of Coketown, this seemed so extraordinary a source of interest to take so much trouble about that it perplexed him. But they were passing the church now, and as his eye caught the clock, he quickened his pace. He was going to his work, the old woman said, quickening hers too, quite easily. Yes, time was nearly out. On his telling her where he worked, the old woman became a more singular old woman than before.
"Aren't you happy?" she asked him.
"Why, there's almost nobody but has their troubles, missus," he answered evasively,
because the old woman appeared to take it for granted that he would be very happy indeed, and he had not the heart to disappoint her.
He knew that there was trouble enough in the world, and if the old woman had lived so long and could count upon his having so little, why, so much the better for her, and none the worse for him.
"Aye, aye, you have your troubles at home, you mean," she said.
"Times, just now and then."